welcome Tim Costello to be among us. Tim tells me that he's the husband of one wife, and he's the father of three children, and nothing else is all that important about him. But in case you're interested, Tim is presently the CEO of World Vision Australia, one of the largest aid agencies in Australia. And in that capacity, Tim is travelling a lot and appears on our public media making comment about various tragic circumstances all around the world. Tim is also known as someone who speaks about social issues like gambling and homelessness and Indigenous affairs. Tim has been in the past a Baptist minister and has been a mayor of St Kilda and has also been awarded a number of very public awards like Victorian of the Year and Order of Australia. Tim, welcome this morning. We're glad you can fit us into your busy schedule and we look forward to what you have to say. And come up, Tim. Thank you. Tim's going to speak for a while, and at the end, if we have time, there'll be opportunity for questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, and that introduction's pretty much as I wrote it, so thank you for that. Sorry for being a little bit late. I made the mistake of staying up to watch the cricket. Wish I hadn't. but lovely to be back in Blackburn. I was with one of my staff who's moving across from Adelaide to take up a position at World Vision, and I said, "Where are you thinking of living?" He said, "We have discovered this fantastic area called Blackburn. And we don't know if we're going to afford to buy here, but we really, really love it. It's just beautiful, isn't it?" I said, "Yes." Then I thought to myself, I spent most of my life trying to get out of Blackburn. Now people are trying to get in. So, but I grew up just across the railway line down in Main Street, Blackburn. My parents lived there till last year, so carved a block out of the orchards. Some of you might remember Blackburn and Orchards. And they were there 54 years. So it's always beautiful to come back to Blackburn. My ministry after law and a bit of work in Box Hill was in studying theology in Switzerland, then going to St Kilda and beginning in both a ministry and a legal office in St Kilda. And the cultural shift to St Kilda was probably harder than going and learning German in Switzerland and being with 30 different nationalities, to actually have a legal office where my first legal client, when she walked in, as soon as I looked at her, I didn't even need to ask what her occupation was. And she was up on charges of loitering for the purposes of prostitution. Said, "Can you help me?" I said, "Yes, of course." Reached for my diary. I remember flicking it open and saying, "Now, when's the case on?" She looked at her watch and she said, "In 5 minutes' time." I discovered that in St Kilda, different to legal practice in Box Hill, where I'd started with Moores, it was a very different sort of expectation. I remember throwing my suit coat on and saying, "Let's get to court. We don't want a warrant issued for your arrest. I'll take instructions as we walk." The court was literally down in Chapel Street where the St Kilda police station is now. The court's been knocked down. As we walked, I was asking her about her prior convictions and the nature of this offence, and I couldn't help but observe and comment on this huge, ugly black eye. It started under her eyelid. It went down through her cheekbone. It ebbed out in her jaw. And I said, "Are you okay? That's a terrible bruise." She was dismissive. She said, no, I'm fine." She said, if you're worried, no, I haven't been bashed." She said, "I'm a heroin addict. That's why I'm prostituting." She said, "I expect I'm probably going to go inside today. So yesterday, thinking I'm going to be locked up, the next day, I went to hit up with heroin, thinking this will be the last hit for a while. And I got frustrated," she said, "when I couldn't find a vein in my arm. So I shot up behind my eye." And I remember freaking. I didn't know this level of violation existed. Coming from leafy Bible Belt Blackburn, this was a huge cultural shift, bigger than going overseas. I remember standing up and putting a plea and convincing the magistrate to fine her, not to put her into prison. She was so over the moon. She threw her arms around me. In a crowd of court, she planted a kiss on my cheek, and she said, "That's a fantastic result." She said this in a crowd of court, everyone listening. "Let me take you out to lunch." I remember freaking for the second time, thinking, this isn't a smart way to begin a legal practice in St Kilda, dining with a sex worker. It's not a terribly smart way to begin a Baptist ministry either. And it is interesting in that split second when you're marshalling your excuses why you just can't possibly accept this invitation. In that nanosecond, the voices you hear. And literally I heard my mother's voice. I've discovered it doesn't matter what age you are, what continent of earth you're on, your mother still reaches you. And my mother's message was very clear. It was, "Timothy, you're known by the company you keep." It was sort of drummed into us. I knew what she thought I should do with this invitation. But I also heard in that nanosecond the voice of God. And it's a voice I take seriously and try and listen to. And that voice, not audible, but still very clear, just said, "What are you scared of?" And I knew my reputation and gossip and what might be said. And I also then knew in that instant that the one I claimed to follow not only risked his reputation by eating with women like her in his time, risked his very life, charged with blasphemy, because he mixed with unclean people and said God loves them. And they too are children of God. So heart in mouth, I remember saying, "That's a very kind invitation. Thank you very much. Where will we go for lunch?" She said, "Oh, the Catholic Church down the road puts on a great free lunch." And I thought, blow, I'm caught. Now I have to go with her. And it was one of these journeys. Sometimes when you read the Bible, there are remarkable journeys where when you start out, people are in a different place, not just geographically, but spiritually and emotionally by the end. Some of you know the story of some disciples on the road to Emmaus and how the ending is so different to what they thought and where they began. The journeys of Abraham. So many journeys. Well, this was my, I guess, archetypal biblical journey. Walking from St Kilda Court down Inkerman, Grey Street, past Greaves, which is particularly the intersection for street prostitution, onto Grey Street where Sacred Heart Mission was with her. Because she literally pointed out the landscape. And this was a very important lesson for me. I thought, because I knew these streets, and I'd been living in St Kilda 3 months or so by then. This is back in 1983. I thought I knew these streets, and I knew what happened on those streets. I learned you actually don't know a place till you see it through someone who really lives there, who walks there, who helps you see what their experience actually involves. There, she pointed out how a St Kilda prostitution street scene works. This stunning woman standing in a micro mini in a corner, she said, actually, she's a policewoman. Because until a man asks for sex for money, there's no offence. Women are charged just for loitering. Men have to actually ask those words for evidence to be there. So policewomen have to play honey traps. She pointed out pimps, who so-called protected, but actually bashed and used the women and lived off their earnings. She pointed out how the street scene works. More drug-affected women like her, literally a segmented market down at one end, compared to those who weren't drug-affected and charged higher prices. She shocked me, saying, by the way, most of the clients are married men. That actually amazed me. And as she was talking like this, I was judging her. I was thinking, this is unbelievable and tragic. And she said, you get into a car with central locking, you don't know if you're going to get bashed or raped or worse. I thought, how can any woman do this? I was judging it. And then my judgment was dissolved. She said, well, I guess you wonder why I do this. And I said, yes. She said, yes, for the heroin. but it wasn't all that way, always that way. She said, when I was 15, one of the many men that came through my mother's life, whom my mother thought she loved, that man raped me. She said, I felt so dirty, I just wanted to die. And when I tried to tell Mum, she didn't believe me and didn't want to follow through the story. So I felt really unsafe and I left home. I stayed at a friend's house until that friend's mother said, has this kid moved in or what? And then went to another friend's house. I soon wore out all my friends. And I ended up on the streets trying to survive. And I thought, well, if this is what men do, I'll make them pay. And growing up in a family in Blackburn where there wasn't that level of violation and lack of safety actually dissolved my judgment. I think I understood really for the first time what Jesus meant when he said, judge not that you be not judged. I was doing that, but I had no idea of what she had been through. We kept walking, and this was really a journey of me starting to understand that many of us, including myself, have often felt very judged when people haven't known what we're struggling with, what our fears are, what our fragilities, why we're trying our best, but people dismiss us, make a comment, and how crippling that is, and how I was doing this to her, how it happens so easily, because we're just sure we know, and we haven't listened and journeyed and seen through someone's eyes. To finish the story, we got to Sacred Heart Mission. I was in a suit. There was a whole lot of street people gathering. Later, St Kilda Baptist, my church was to set up a similar place called the House of Hope. But this was my first encounter with psychiatrically ill and drug affected and homeless and sex workers all gathering for lunch. She was so proud to have me as her guest. She told everybody to shut up. She said, this is Tim Costello, my lawyer. He's the best lawyer in St Kilda. And I waved and smiled and felt really, you know, proud. Thought, oh, gee, I'll hand out my cards. This is perfect. We sat down and started the meal. And then after about 15 minutes, I noticed she looked up and looked around. And she saw more people had arrived who hadn't had the benefit of her announcement. So she got up again, introduced me again. Said, if you're in trouble, this is the person you need to go to. And I'm waving, smiling, feeling a bit embarrassed. And I'll never forget this. From a distant table, this guy looked at me, a homeless guy, shook his head in disbelief, said in a voice loud enough for everyone to hear, God, he said, things must be tough if lawyers have to eat here. So the journey from Blackburn via Switzerland, certainly to St Kilda, where I worked as a lawyer, worked as a minister, grew a church, ended up on St Kilda Council as the mayor of St Kilda. In fact, the last mayor ever of St Kilda. I did such a great job. Kennett abolished the councils. But it was actually a journey of understanding my faith and understanding what it means to follow Jesus, which is really the story I want to talk to you this morning about, and the 40 days of purpose that I think you've started and will be invited to be part of, really is just an opportunity to think about your journey. What does faith mean? What does meaning mean? Where does it take me? For me, ministry in St Kilda was actually an incredibly important part of this journey. I'd done my theology, I'd learned to read the New Testament in Greek and the Old Testament Hebrew, of course, but the cross-cultural application and translation of my faith in St Kilda meant learning a language of the street and a language of subcultures. And the people who had the biggest impact on me were people who initially really annoyed me. And again, I was judging. I'll never forget, because St Kilda Baptist was the only church that had an evening service, put on a cup of tea and a biscuit, where we could always guarantee a full church. The only problem was it was full of people from boarding houses and homeless backgrounds who could never get through a church service without going out for a smoke. Later at the House of Hope, when we set up a street service just for them. We let them smoke in the service because, you know, trying to get through an hour without a smoke was pretty hard. Well, they annoyed me because a number of them appeared to be really serious about their faith, in fact, self-identified as Christians. But in my mind, a Christian looked like me. A Christian actually was responsible and disciplined, even in very small things like personal hygiene. Here were people like Eva, an Aboriginal woman who couldn't actually get their personal hygiene together terribly well. They're always on the nose. That offended me. I thought, they really can't be a true follower of Jesus. They offended me in the way they went about their lives. Eva would often give away her last $5 to someone in need, not knowing how she was going to eat for the next couple of days. I felt a Christian was responsible. You know, you save for the future. You save for that education or that house deposit. You planned ahead. For me, the journey of understanding my faith was actually rereading the New Testament. I could read it in Greek, but that didn't help me necessarily understand it. Here was Jesus and the disciples, I realized, who probably, in personal hygiene terms, had more in common with Eva than with me. There weren't Rheem hot water systems around there, and it was dirty, dusty Palestine. And here was Jesus, who never had a house. He said, foxes have holes, birds have nests, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Here was Jesus, it seemed, that when there was an opportunity to experience hospitality, you put anything and everything you had into it. Actually, he might have had more in common with Eva and others who identified as Christians than with my values. Now, I don't apologize for being middle class. That's who I am. I think ahead. I plan ahead. What I started to learn was, in faith perspective, to actually say Eva and her friends coming to my church couldn't be real Christians because they weren't like me was the journey. To start to realize there are different subcultures that we often identify as Christian and overlay a particular one as Christian and others as non-Christian. I think going to Switzerland had actually started this journey for me because there I discovered that English Baptists all drank and smoked. That's not what Australian Baptists did. In my head, that actually was proof you really weren't following Christ. Italian Baptists, and this really shocked me, Italian Baptists all voted communist. Now, it was Berlinger, softer, almost social democratic communism. It wasn't Stalinism. This is back in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. But coming from Blackburn, where we knew God was in heaven and Bob Menzies was in the lodge, and all Christians voted liberal, most of my family still believe that, to actually meet people training for the Baptist ministry who voted communist, they had pretty good reasons when I started working it out. They actually said, the Christian Democrats are in power in Italy, so in league with the mafiosa, only the communists will clean up this corruption. It wasn't a bad argument. Well, this was a journey of saying, boy, what is following Jesus and Christian about my faith and what is cultural? Because here were now some really confronting surprises that pushed me back. I had just assumed Christians voted this way, looked this way, had these views. This experience, I guess, has continued in World Vision. It's the experience of saying maybe you don't really fully understand your faith until you test it in some cross-cultural situations. What's actually just upbringing, which has been given a dressing up as, of course, this is Christian Jesus, and what actually does it mean to really say I'm following Christ, to be able to love like he did, and give and serve like he did. Well, without going through a whole biographical journey, I think you see how, for me, the question of what does it mean to be a Christian? How do I follow? How am I faithful? What does God call me to do has been incredibly important. Sometimes young people say to me, wow, CEO of World Vision, that's fantastic. I'd love in my career to end up there. Can you give me advice how to do that? It's always a really tough question for me because I did law, worked as a criminal lawyer and a family lawyer. I got a bit, really, not depressed, but anxious that most of my work was just reactive. On the steps of court, your client was always totally repentant and going to turn their lives around. Once you got them off, they went back usually the old ways, and you felt you didn't make much difference. Family law, of course, is tragic. People who've loved each other now fighting desperately over kids or property or whatever. So I had actually stepped out of law and gone and studied theology, and then I'd come back and worked in a storefront legal firm in the church. We placed the firm in St Kilda, and a Baptist minister, a mayor. I then went and worked at Collins Street Baptist as both the minister setting up an organisation called Urban Seed. I might say that the key leaders leading Urban Seed were helped in their spiritual journey by this church. People like Marcus Curnow and Chris Lacey, and you'll remember Greg Hewson and others. But there I was working with homeless and drug affected, and trying to say to the corporate people in Melbourne, from 101 Collins to others, you know a lot about markets. You know everything about markets. But there's a drug market, second biggest market after armaments, right under your nose, happening here in the streets of Melbourne, you know nothing about. And Urban Seed was taking city stockbrokers on walks onto back lanes, saying this is part of our reality. And this reality, by the way, isn't just people from tragically sad, hopeless families. Again and again, the people we were dealing with had been people who'd grown up with private school education and good families. I remember sitting with one person who surprised me. I convinced him to get into a drug detox center we'd set up in St Kilda called The First Step. And he said, my parents will be really pleased that I'm going into drug detox and going to try and be straight. And then he said something that I heard many times. He said, but I don't want to end up like my parents. I thought, there'll be a story of abuse, of family cruelty or suffering or something. So I asked him, why don't you want to end up like your parents? And he floored me because he said, my parents are incredibly successful professionals, both with really successful businesses. But my parents have to have a diary to make a dinner date to see their friends. Nobody rings up. Nobody drops it by. My parents are really lonely. That's what floored me. He was really telling me that after he was clean, he knew he couldn't go back to his friends who are on the street. But he said, you know, those people are always there. Even if you're shooting up or scoring, you talk footy, you laughed, you talked about things that really mattered. I'm really scared that when I come out clean and I can't go back to those friends, there's going to be no one for me. And I'm going to end up like my parents. The profound importance of knowing that you matter, that there's community, that there are others around. Well, my journey, when I say to a young person, how do you get to be CEO of World Vision, hasn't been a career path journey. It's not now. Do this, and after international relations, get a job in government, and then come and join an NGO, and then, you know, the board will be looking at you as a future CEO. It's been a very haphazard journey. But it has been a journey that I think fits with what you're trying to study, the 40 days of purpose. It's been a journey that actually has focused on vocation rather than career. I often say to young people, there are two ladders. One's called career, and a parallel ladder called vocation. The career ladder, which is perfectly normal and natural, you all understand. Your parents have said, study hard at school. They've been on your back. And if you ask why, they'll usually say, because then you can get into university and into a faculty that, you know, really sets you off on a career. Once you get into that faculty, the parents say, study hard now at law school or arts or marketing, whatever it is you're doing. And if you ask why, because then when you finish, you can get a job with one of the better firms. And you've climbed a few rungs of this career ladder. Do well in school, do well in university, get into that company or firm that's a good first-tier firm. And then you look up and you say, oh, there's another 10 rungs to climb, and then I'd be general manager or CEO or whatever it is. The other ladder is vocation. And I think this goes to purpose. Vocation comes from the Latin word voca, I'm called. A vocation is a calling. In religious, particularly Catholic terms, a vocation is, you know, when you decide you're going into particularly an order. Vocation starts, you climb the first rung when you ask the question, why am I here? It's a really important question. Another urban seat story, sitting with some young people, just chewing the fat, literally in the gutter. I was listening to the conversation. I said something that's dead easy for a Baptist minister to say to one young guy. He was talking pretty nihilistically. I said, I believe God made you. And I watched his eyes fill up with tears. And they literally started rolling down his face. And he said, God made me. He said, my old man told me I was just an accident. He said, I wasn't meant to be here. He effectively told me, you know, it's just been a burden all my life because I was just an accident. God made me. The importance of actually affirming, why am I here? That's the first rung of vocation. The next rung you climb is, and what is it for me to do? Now, sometimes that vocation will overlap beautifully with a career. If you're paid to do the thing that you're really called to do, that's a really sweet spot. It doesn't always work out that way. But vocation says, what is it that I'm called to do? What is it that if I don't do it, I am going to be poorer and the world's going to be poorer? Because this is how God made me. God made me for purpose, to do those things. And vocation, I think, you climb that ladder, which is parallel to the career one, as you follow that calling. Sometimes making decisions that are anti-career, making decisions that don't necessarily just say more social significance and a bigger pay packet and more influence, which the career one is essentially organized around climbing. People who go to the mission field, people who make decisions about how their gift, it might be their art or their music, rather than being paid a lot of money for something else, they're going to explore and give time to, even at a financial cost. I think this is the vocational question. What is it that God has made me to do? Why am I here? What is this about for me? Well, this goes to the heart of the question of purpose. For me, the purpose hasn't changed and it has been tweaked. From early days, I've had a Christian faith. If you'd asked me at the age of 18, down at Blackburn Baptist across the way there, what the message of Jesus was, I would have gone like this. Well, Jesus, after being born in Bethlehem, growing up in Nazareth, began his ministry at 30. And I guess he went around Galilee telling people to become Christians and to go to church. That's what I would have said. Why? Because that's what we were trained in youth group and beach mission. Peter and I were out actually preaching as 17, 18-year-olds with a group called Open Air Campaigners. In fact, when people say to me, how come your brother's so good on his feet in Parliament, I say open-air preaching. That's how. you learn skills there, which really are quite remarkable. And can I say to those of you who are in churches, the skills young people learn in churches are often much more important than even the university degrees and the other professions. I say that personally. The skills of being mentored by someone older, being given opportunities to speak, to lead, to do music, they're quite remarkable skills. There are not too many groups in society that meet every week. and encourage young people and give them feedback and give them opportunities. We often take this for granted in a social capital sense, what it does, investing in young people. But what we were trained to do was to actually see more people come to Christ. And when they came to Christ, to join the church. So that was the purpose. Jesus went around Galilee telling people, because this is what we did, to become Christians and to go to church. And if someone asked us, is there any more purpose to it than that? We said, well, that person has become a Christian and has gone to church. Their job's to tell someone else to become a Christian and to tell someone else, and this is how the church grows. This is what it's all about. What I believe, and I still believe evangelism and going to church is really important, but what I believe now is this, that Jesus didn't come into Galilee doing that. Jesus, when he began his ministry at 30, announced that the kingdom of God is at hand. That this kingdom changes the lens that we look at life through. It reorders our priorities. It touches politics and economics. It touches the way we go about raising our kids, our neighborliness. This kingdom breaking in is a whole new social spiritual order. It's a very big message, and it's a very complex message at one level, although I think if you want to simplify it, this kingdom at heart is simply Jesus announcing God is intentional about setting the world right. In Eugene Peterson's translation of the Lord's Prayer, he uses that phrase, setting the world right. Thy kingdom come on earth is setting the world right, environmentally, socially, politically. This is what the kingdom of God is actually about. So someone coming to faith to follow Jesus, yep, great to share their faith and see others come to faith. But actually, the big point is now to be on a journey to set the world right, to offer what you're called to do, your vocation, into the mix of setting the world right. This, for me, was an important discovery. It's a discovery that led me into local government. Many of the people I was working with in St Kilda were actually being forced out of St Kilda, long-term homeless and psychiatrically ill and poor. And it was pretty obvious why St Kilda had been discovered. It had been the old tart of Melbourne, you know, Sleaze City. People said, hey, it's only 5 kilometres from the city and it's on the bay. And we can turn those workmen's cottages with their briquette heaters into really trendy places with heritage colours and open fireplaces, central heating, of course. Up go the rents, up go the prices. And a lot of St Kilda's poor that I work with being forced out to the back of Broadmeadows. I was reading my Bible with this context of setting the world right. And Isaiah speaks of, they shall plant vineyards and drink of the vine. They shall build houses, and no longer shall others live in the houses they build. The prophet Isaiah, no longer shall others live in the houses they build. And it really spoke to me about the housing crisis in St Kilda and who was being forced out. And I ran on a platform of putting ratepayers' dollars into affordable housing for long-term St Kilda poor. Because at least in St Kilda, the kids get to go to the beach and there's public transport at the back of Broadmeadows and Dandenong. It's actually a much lessened quality of life. And we became the first council in Australia to put ratepayers' dollars into affordable housing. And my inauguration of mayor, I quoted from Isaiah. No longer shall they build houses and others live in them. This was my motivation, but it came from the sense of setting the world right. This is the kingdom Jesus preached. The signature of that kingdom, the signature of Jesus' preaching was this. And this kingdom is good news for the poor. Again and again, that emphasis comes out. And it's good news for the poor. Well, this was my discovery of my vocation, whatever there was in law and local politics. How does that connect with setting the world right? Jesus teaching us the Lord's Prayer which isn't escape theology, that I'm saved, so I've got this ticket to the great U2 concert in the sky. My table's booked, I'm there. What does it mean to transform now? Thy kingdom come on earth, thy will be done on earth. This is for here now, as well as a hope beyond the grave. I think that sense of purpose and vocation has been, you know, the passion of my life. It's helped me reread the Bible. Growing up in a Baptist church, we Baptists had the franchise on hellfire sermons. We are pretty good at that. As I look back on my upbringing, I never ever heard a sermon on Matthew 25. And it's the perfect judgment setting. God is on his throne, the nations are gathered, he's dividing him into sheep and goats, heaven and hell. How come I never heard an evangelistic sermon on that perfect setting? Was it because it didn't quite fit our theology? Well, the job is just to see people become Christians and go to church. That story, the judgment, is on the basis of, did you feed the hungry and clothe the naked and visit those in prison? Did you set the world right? I never heard a sermon on the rich man and Lazarus. There is a stinging text for a hellfire brimstone sermon, because the rich man is burning, if you know the story. He's burning so much he pleads, can Lazarus, who's up in the bosom of Abraham, come and dip his finger in the flame and cool the fire? Wow, perfect for an evangelistic text. Why didn't I ever hear an evangelistic sermon on that? I must admit, often when I read that text, I wondered what the sin of the rich man was that he was burning. Growing up as a Baptist, I thought, I know what it is. I bet he was a closet gay. That would be the heinous sin. That would be the reason he's burning. Well, I think the story that Jesus tells is pretty clear, isn't it? The rich man's sin was he ignored the poor man at his gate. Here is the same theme about setting the world right, about good news for the poor. In World Vision's work, this kingdom theology is fundamentally important. It's a theology that has had to take a step back and say, gee, how did we become, as Christians reading our Bible, so profoundly disconnected from the creation God made? Why weren't Christians leading the green movement? Here is God, creator of all, saying the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the creation that bears his image. And now we're discovering in World Vision work that climate change is the greatest threat to development, undoing even potentially 50 years of development. And Liz's husband, Tony, one of our best workers, doing extraordinary work across Africa in terms of planting acacia trees, which reforest, and also are a food supply. Having just come back from Ethiopia, I was up there filming with Hugh Jackman. Well, we're mainly filming him, not me. And it's lovely for Hugh in Ethiopia, because actually Ethiopians didn't really know Hugh. I remember the first morning we're outside a church, and this Ethiopian guy looks at us filming and goes to Hugh, what's your name? He says, Hugh Jackman. Oh, what do you do? Hugh says, I'm an actor. The guy goes, okay, and walks off. I saw Hugh's face was pretty devastated. This had never happened to Hugh Jackman before. It's terrific. But there in Ethiopia, 95% of the forests are gone. 80 million people and too little land, and Tony and World Vision and others leading magnificent reforestation projects, which also are a fodder supply and a food supply. Because for them it's not just an environmental issue, but it often is for us, it's a survival issue. Cutting down the forest for your little wood fires and stoves is actually the way you cook and get light. You'll see it later in the year when it's on TV. Hugh shoveling manure in his Gucci boots. A local coffee farmer that we've given a biogas converter to, into his mud-walled, no windows, mud floor. They just sleep on the mud floor, thatched roof hut. And biogas is literally manure put in a hole with sort of a plastic thing that captures it all, concrete that literally stops the greenhouse gas going up and polluting the atmosphere and pumps that biogas into a little thatched hut. And suddenly you're cooking on gas. And you've got light for your kids at night. So the kids and the family, and we went into these thatch huts, aren't breathing the smoke in from the fires with terrible respiratory consequences. We had to get out after 15 minutes. Our eyes were stinging. We were coughing. They live with that. They're not cutting down the forest, the little that remains, because there's biogas. There's a hand up, not just a hand out, because that farmer who's been given the biogas, the deal is the first calf from his cow goes back to the village. There's a growing community wealth, and the next families are getting the biogas. The farmer's name is Ducali. I love this, watching Hugh work with him for about 2.5 hours, you know, hot, sweating. I said, come on, Hugh, we've got to do the shower scene from Australia now. The thing I loved was this Ducali, who Hugh worked with, and the whole village was watching this, you know, what's going on here, had no idea who Hugh Jackman was. But working together bonds you. It's really interesting. We often say you learn from listening or hearing. You learn from doing. Hugh, working with him, says on camera, I will take a vow only to drink fair trade coffee. I always believe if you worked hard, you got ahead. I've been working with Ducali and other coffee farmers. They're not getting ahead. And it's because there are market forces where middle people get the cut, not the farmer. Fair trade is to ensure there's a fair wage. So Hugh says this on camera. But the bonding with Ducali was really significant as they're having the little coffee ceremony in the hut after they've been working for 2.5 hours. I noticed this farmer, Ducali, speaks not a word of English. Hugh doesn't speak Ethiopian. He's holding Hugh's hand and sitting on his lap. There is this quite extraordinary bonding of two worlds, you know, have no idea where they've come from, but the incredible joy and solidarity of working and saying, you know, we want to make sure others get methane digesters so this village can not go on cutting down the forest. Well, this is setting the world right. This is taking the kingdom of God seriously. It's actually what I think Jesus was on about, announcing that this kingdom of God that's amongst us and coming calls for us to reorder our priorities. That's what repentance basically means. Priorities that have put the poor last, that have failed to deal with the conditions that allow every child of God, every person made in the image of God, to have clean water and access to enough food and access to biogas rather than cutting down the forest. And interestingly, isn't it profoundly, seamlessly connected with our reality? As Hugh and I sat with the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, who's leading the 53 African nations in the climate change negotiations, he was saying, you know, the West actually now has to deal with us. Once it was charity, the poor over there. Now, because if we don't get a post-Copenhagen agreement, now Western countries will be impacted because climate change knows no boundaries. It's become in the self-interest of the West to also deal with reforestation and our need and our poverty. This global village has actually said it's no longer just about charity. It's all about how we survive together, literally as God's children in one global village, trying to set it right in terms of its priorities. To quote a former Australian Prime Minister, Paul Keating, who I think pinched this quote from Jack Lang, the Premier of New South Wales, the old colourful Premier. Keating, Lang said, always in a two-horse race, back the horse called self-interest. Because at least you know it's trying. Well, dealing with poverty has always been a little bit of, you know, charity and compassion, and they are fantastic motivations and profoundly important as humans and as Christians. I don't want to minimize that. But interestingly, now dealing with poverty against the backdrop of climate change has also become aligned with self-interest. We actually have to do this together. We've got to find an agreement together. This is what Copenhagen's about. And for us in World Vision, it's urgent. From the 60 countries we're in, the same reports just come in over and over again. Our field is saying we may not be scientists and we can't settle the question of whether it's human-induced contribution to climate change, but we can tell you this, the monsoons have failed again. The areas where we would get two crops, we're going to get one crop. The fundamental changes pushing people out of rural areas, we have never seen in living memory. The amount of humanitarian emergencies that we have to respond to has profoundly changed due, I believe, to climate change. In 1950, 50 natural disasters in Southeast Asia. 2006, 250. When I got into Burma, one of the few expats to get in after Cyclone Nargis, that took 150,000 lives. Devastating. What amazed me was every Burmese said to me, "We don't believe this. Of course there are cyclones in our region. But they've always missed us and hit Bangladesh." This has never, ever happened in our history. Something's changed. What's going on? Well, never before have we needed the message of Jesus, the kingdom of God, setting the world right, good news for the poor, shaking up our priorities, and our part in that, which is vocationally saying, why has God made me? What has he called me to do? What is the gift I've got that I must offer to be part of the task of setting the world right? Thank you.
Tim, I know you have other things that you need to do today, so unfortunately we're not going to have time to ask questions, but Tim's given us a lot to think about. He's been very revealing in his own journey from this mixed blessing of growing up in Blackburn, which some of us share with you, and being a Christian, and then finding that maybe not everyone thinks, looks, even smells the same as you do, as you cross cultures, even as close as St Kilda, let alone Burma and other parts of the world. You've tested us to think about the two ladders. Some of us might be on career ladders, might not be very happy on those ladders, but we recognise that we've been on those ladders, or we're parents and maybe setting our children on those ladders. On the one hand, the career, and on the other, the vocational ladder. Why am I here? What does God want me to do with this life? And then, Tim, you've also challenged us to think broadly about what it means to be a person of faith, about helping put the world to right in some way. It might not be going and helping Hugh Jackman learn about methane gas, but it might be something a bit more approachable here in Melbourne, or it might be some of you are called to other tasks around the world. Certainly in this church, there are people that go off and do all sorts of amazing things in many different parts of the world. So thank you, Tim. Thank you for the challenge. Thank you for the challenge for those of you sitting here who are people who try and follow Jesus. I think you'll have felt some of that challenge. And for those of you sitting here this morning who may not have begun that journey and have come along just to hear and think, welcome. And we hope that some of what Tim has said might have spoken to you about your purpose, and maybe there is a God there that's speaking to you and is challenging you to think more about who you are.